I'll reconvene. Ms. Scott,
Mr. Gazzard has checked. He did actually find it, and he had no questions and has more as it turns out. So,
okay.
He's free to go.
Thank you, sir. So if we start with objective 8.2.1, thinking now about the objective having one role in terms of helping structure the distribution of the zones at the plan making level, and at the other end being something that's an applicant pursuing a non-complying activity consent might want to test an application against, or the council might. I just wanted to get clarity with you. The way it's worded, medium density development has to be close to a town centre and a local shopping zone and an activity centre and a public transport route and non-vehicular trails, all of them. Or is the idea that development has to be close to a mix of them or some of them or otherwise? But as worded, it seems like it's quite a high bar, and I wonder if all of the proposed zones themselves could qualify being close to all of those things simultaneously.
No, they don't have to. I would want them to have to satisfy all of those things, because that would be quite difficult for a number of the locations. However, a combination of them would make it better. Because you wouldn't want to say it's an or thing, because as soon as someone is close to a non-vehicular trail, then, you know, we've got quite a few of those in the district. It would be more of a combination of them. So, yeah, I take what you're saying, and I can look at a meeting.
I think it's very effective, and even if you look at it in the way that you've just suggested, how does the Skua Heights land meet that objective?
I've always seen Skua Heights land as an anomaly in the zoning. It is right beside a non-vehicular trail, though, as we've heard.
Yes.
it is an anomaly. I think that whoever drafted this saw it as a big chunk of land that was ripe for redevelopment.
It is, does immediately adjoin both primary schools.
Yes.
And it's very close to the high school. Is that what is intended by activity centres? That's where the objective falls down, because it's unclear. Town centres are clear. Local shopping zones is clear. But then there are no public transport routes in Waikato.
No.
And even the ones here are pretty few and far between. There are lots of non-vehicular trails. Is just a little bit more clarity? I mean, I can see the benefit of being close to schools. And in fact, from memory, that was one of the reasons the Environment Court gave for granting the North Lake development, that was close to schools.
I think that is the intention of activity centre. It's meant to be something that otherwise attracts people to a particular location, and schools would definitely be that situation, particularly when you've just got the one, you've got the two in that location. Activity centres is not defined in the plan as well, so it is difficult. I can look at them using them to be a little bit...
Maybe it's helpful to think about not getting trapped trying to write every single thing that it might be okay to be close to, and then figuring out what combinations of those.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe something a touch more generic about where residents are close enough to or can walk to
activities to help meet their daily needs or something that one, helps defend all of the council's proposed zones to start with, and two, for instance, I wouldn't have thought that schools count as activity centres, and I'd have thought being close to a school would actually not pass the objective based on what it says here. So, but look, if you can just reconsider the words based on the conversation and your own opinion on what you think is intended, that might suffice there. So,
and just to, I'm wondering whether you consider whether policies could be helpful to provide clarity as to how that a more generally worded objective could be given effect to. In terms of the locational aspects, because that doesn't seem to have been carried forward. It's only on the nature of the development rather than why it's been, where it's located.
Could I suggest that under that heading, 8.3.1.3, sort of comes towards it's a redrafted example.
Okay.
Just a suggestion on the
topic. Yeah.
It's not quite as specific as and all inclusive as the actual objective itself. The policy conversion at all.
Can I just clarify? So 8.2.1, so if that was made to be more generic about the location, we've got policy 8.2.1.1, which effectively repeats that. So is that what you're saying, is that perhaps look at amending that one as well?
Yes, I mean policies are, the purpose of policy is to show how the objective will be implemented rather than what the locational sense policy should enunciate how the objective will be given flesh, if you like, rather than trying to answer all the questions in the objective.
Okay, so proposed policy 8.2.1.3. I think I understand what's being intended, but my question is whether, as worded, the only method containing the outward spread of residential growth is the zone. Maybe it's contribute to containing or something that might be a bit.
Yeah, this zone is just one element of the toolkit.
Yeah. So I'd have thought someone, I think even yesterday, that the low density residential zone was about 80% of the residential zoning. Mm-hmm. And I'd struggle to see how a relatively small zone, the medium density zone, could be held up as containing outward growth. 8.2.2. I'm going to ask you a question about whether you consider a particular matter, but before I ask the question, I'll just declare that it relates to a step that Auckland has taken in its plan, and I was one of the witnesses that promoted the approach to the panel that agreed with it. And that was that what was found there was this tension between trying to provide for growth and change, but at the same time keep things the way they are. And one of the issues that was found was that every time objectives and policies talked about maintaining amenity, that was used by people opposed to development to say
well, my amenity is not being maintained, therefore this monstrous development that might generally comply with a lot of the plan's controls couldn't be appropriate. And so one of the steps that was taken was to start referencing future character or the planned character and amenity values, not instead of, but as well as any existing amenity values. And one of the reasons that was promoted was that when analyses only looked at what was there now and what was there yesterday, it was capturing effectively a defence of the status quo, that anything that changed that would be inherently adverse. And so I'm just going to, the question I'm asking was sort of light of that rant, sorry, was just to say, did you think about these kind of issues when you were wording these provisions, and are you comfortable that as currently worded, the requirement to respond to what reads as effectively what's there now isn't going to limit or undermine the opportunities for change, that the balance of the objectives of policy that are otherwise seeking in the zone?
I thought that in redrafting that the words which I've inserted, the positively responsive site neighbourhood and wider context, were better than the notified complement and enhanced local character, heritage and identity for those reasons. But I accept what you're saying, that yes, always when there's a proposal out there to do something a bit beyond what is currently there, this kind of a statement is always championed.
Possibly responds is an interesting use of words, because it can mean both, either or both of, it's a beneficial, good outcome, but it could also mean positively taking advantage of the plan's enablement, i.e. it's not necessarily saying residents can hide behind, we don't think you're making it better, therefore it's not positive.
Yeah.
So I can understand that, and again, that's language that's becoming more common in plans elsewhere.
Can I ask you a question about the future character or plan character? So was that defined, or was that provided through like design guidelines or something like that?
It was effectively worded so that it was referring to the outcomes described within the objectives and policies of the zone. So the benchmark was the kind of intensive outcomes that were described was part of what was informing the assessment of applications. So it's effectively, are you achieving the vision of the policy, as opposed to do you match what happens to be in the environment right now? And I'm not suggesting it's the right thing, I'm not suggesting this doesn't do it, I'm just sharing an experience I've seen and was asking, because we've got some similar language there, whether you'd come across that or you had any thoughts on it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think positively responds to the site neighbourhood and wider context, yeah, could be seen to be seen both ways, but yeah, perhaps something more along the, we're acknowledging what's there, but we're allowing a little bit more because of the new zone needed to be taken into account.
Well, I think the discussion that the panel in Auckland got interested in was the distinction between maintaining existing amenity values or creating new amenity values on the basis of some parts of the district, like Arrowtown, might be very much about maintaining or almost conserving, and other parts of the district, like perhaps this zone, might be more about helping bring about something that's new. And I think we heard yesterday from Mr. Falconer that the kind of densities and outcomes that were sought in the zone were still relatively new to the district. Relied on that in defence of things like more use of the urban design plan. And so I think greater clarity in some of these provisions about whether we're maintaining what's there or creating something high quality and new might be more helpful. But thanks anyway for your comments on positively response and what you were trying to achieve. 8.2.2.6. I had a question that's crossing over from planning into the legal side of plan construction. I could understand 8.2.2.6 if it was phrased more clearly under something like 104.1c. But even then, I'm not sure the word require is a fair hurdle. You're required to take account of something that doesn't exist yet. So the council could do a study that actually says, actually, we don't even support our own operative zone anymore. What does that mean? So I wonder whether that policy is inappropriately forceful and difficult for us to probe meaningfully in the absence of any idea of what it could actually mean.
No, I think it's fair. I can look at the changing the reply to something a little bit less.
I had a problem in that. If any council adopted design guide is not adopted into the plan by reference, how far can a policy go to require or even encourage compliance with it?
It's probably strange beyond my expertise, and I may ask Ms. Scott for help here, but that wasn't my intention. So it was notified with a similar policy, as you'll see, and there were the submissions that said, hey, this could open us up to many things, and that was my solution. But knowing that the medium density design guidelines were perhaps going to be on the cards, I thought that I could perhaps keep the policy in, and then that's how that would refer to it without the need to reference those, but I'm unsure whether that actually legally can.
Don't think it would help me here. How far do these guidelines fall over into building controls, building codes within the area?
Amy, the proposed medium density design.
Well, the same would apply to area town design guidelines, for example. And you also have building codes on the other hand. So if someone wants to do something, what about the law?
Oh, okay. So the design guidelines are more about, you know, the scale, nature, design of the building, what materials are used, what kind of plants you can plant in some instances. So that's completely different to the actual structural integrity of the building, which is what your building code would look at.
So if I were to follow the board up to my house and medium density design, I want to demolish it, what do I get and build something else? Can I go to the building code and carry on, or have I got to go to the design guidelines?
If the district plan would require you to look at the design guidelines, you'd have to look, and you need resource consent, you'd have to look at those too.
So any building with a medium density zone is going to have to get resource consent?
No, we're proposing up to 3. Sorry.
Well, it just seems to be, to me, as a grey area here.
And well, I think the difficulty goes back to if there are no medium density design guidelines, we'll set our town to one site because that has its own objective and policies. Then, and if there were to be medium density design guidelines, they would be incorporated into the plan by reference through a plan change. At that point would be the appropriate time to deal with the policy as to how they were to be given effect to, I would have thought, rather than us trying to second guess now what the policy framework could be for something that we haven't seen. And it's unlikely that this panel, this constituted panel, would see them either. So I think that's probably a more fundamental question of the problem with it than Commissioner Munro or Commissioner Hazard have raised.
Yeah. I don't object to anything you've just said. We will consider this and respond and reply. Mm. But I accept that there are issues with the policy as it's structured.
Just the context of all the policies in 8.2.2, the objective at 8.2.2 talks about site, neighbourhood and wider context. Policy 8.2.2.1 is about streets. 8.2.2.2 is about streets. 8.2.2.3 is about streets. And I wonder if the policies are to have such a focus on at least streets, if not public spaces generally, whether some reference to that really should be added to site, neighbourhood and wider context.
Is the question about,
in light of how many of the policies under objective 8.2.2
mm-hmm.
relate solely or predominantly to streets,
yeah,
whether streets should be referenced in the objective itself that the policies are then emphasising?
Yes, I guess I've taken a wider
approach
with neighbourhood there, but yes, yeah, that could be referenced in the objective as well.
Well, I think what prompted me was when I read policy 8.2.2.5, and at the back end of that it actually says with particular regard to the street frontage, and it just seems that while neighbourhood does include things like streets, it seems that the policies are seeking to elevate the importance of streets within that to a level that isn't currently reflected in the objective. And I'm just musing with you whether or not that is the optimum outcome of construction.
Yeah, well, that's probably quite clear, given that when you look at the policies under 8.2.3, they're more about the actual sites and the amenity of neighbouring sites. So, yeah, this one could perhaps be scaled back to be about streets.
Well, I was only suggesting whether the streets were particularly identified by being added, not necessarily taking anything else away, but again, maybe you can just reflect on that alignment between what the policies are saying and make sure you're comfortable that the objective is clear that that's what's intended.
And just following on from that, it's the question whether the objective is focused on the public realm aspect of the neighbourhood. And that's where the streets are coming
in. At 8.2.4.1, in terms of the kind of norms we see around how policies get worded, usually the word provide is used when a council is offering to do something rather than require, which is the kind of word used when it's expected that an applicant or developer would do something. And so when I read this policy, I read it going, who was actually being asked to provide these great things? Because it isn't clear that it's intended, if it is intended, that applicants or developers would be expected to facilitate a whole connection or a contribution to one through perhaps their site or otherwise. So what's in your mind intended?
I didn't actually think about council being the people that would do it, so perhaps if the council had land which it was developing, or
the council could just use rate money to pay for things. The council also has to live by its district plan.
Yeah, that's right. So in my mind at the time, it was about applicants and where perhaps through the design guidelines or some other document, then we may have, council may have identified potential for a linkage between streets that might promote these things, that that's where that policy would come in.
Yeah, I was interested in the contrast between this particular policy and the policy of 8.2.6.1, which seems remarkably similar, only in 8.2.6.1 it talks about existing or planned connections, where 8.2.4.1 just says give us a connection to something that may or may not even be wanted or necessary. So that talks about existing or planned trail and track networks. And I'm talking about 8.2.6.1 now.
Yeah, it does appear to be a
double up. Yeah, so another question was whether we in fact need both policies.
I don't think so. I don't think it's, although the word is different, I think the intent is the same. I probably prefer the wording of 8.2.6.1 about the existing or plan.
Okay, well perhaps you can just have a think about that. But even if then we're talking about now 8.2.6.1, are you comfortable that there is a sort of self-explaining obviousness that if someone is just developing a single site in the zone, they're not going to be asked to make a financial contribution to some trail somewhere else or some other? So I can understand in the context of a quite comprehensive large-scale development that maybe is building new streets and it's opening up an area of greenfield land, that maybe connecting these sort of things could be a very appropriate thing to do, but in terms of the more urban existing developed areas of the zone where there's maybe no need or desire for anything, you're comfortable that's sufficiently clear? So for instance, 8.2.6.1 doesn't actually talk about those links being adjacent to or close to development. It just says everyone doing medium density housing is going to somehow connect to or facilitate a connection to these great things.
I hadn't thought of the idea that this was perhaps put in someone's head that you should contribute to the Mountain Foreign Trail or something. So yeah, it's a good point. So perhaps some wording along the lines of adjacent.
I think we just want to be absolutely certain we understand what the policies are trying to do, and then we can satisfy ourselves that the wording proposed actually does that. But at the moment, I just think that's one example of a bit of ambiguity that as you can imagine, we have to not play devil's advocate, but we have to try and represent the best of every possible viewpoint. And anyway, okay, good. So back up to 8.2.4.2. We've got positive connections, street and public places, ease of walkability. But then if we go from 8.2.4.2 to 8.2.2.1, we're talking about address streets, 2.2 connected streets, and so on. And so I wonder whether again we're getting close to a degree of repetition in terms of relate to streets and promote walkability. Maybe could be said in less than three policies.
Yeah, I agree. There's some repetition there. I can look at those two.
I think what Commissioner Munro has highlighted perhaps is the objective 8.2.2 and objective 8.2.4 are possibly interlinked.
Yeah.
And that there may actually not be two separate objectives, but one objective, which is the design and the neighbourhood relationship intermingled. I think that's where the difficulty of these common pluralised policies comes from.
Yeah, I agree.
that'll do in terms of the objectives of policy. Just a few other questions to round it out. At 8.5.8, could you just help me understand the rationale and basis for a 4.5 metre garage setback?
This came from Mr. Falconer's evidence. The rationale, from recollection, was only really to do with there'd be enough space in 4.5 to park a vehicle in front of the garage. However, it was also to do with trying to break up a flat facade and minimise the dominance of the garage in that facade, I understand as well.
Yeah, so when I read Mr. Falconer's evidence, I didn't read anything about the parking a car, but I read all the other stuff about visual dominance and some sight line issue and what have you, but anyway, that's helpful because I'm more familiar with a dimension more like 5 to 5.5 metres being used to accommodate a car such that it won't block a footpath. So perhaps we could, if one purpose of the setback is to ensure a car can be parked in front of a garage, perhaps you could just run that by the council's relevant traffic people just to make sure that 4.5, either Queenstown has smaller cars than the rest of the country or the rest of the country is being spatially generous. So that should be straightforward. At 8.5.14, this is another topic I've seen many rules for. So what's happened in some other places is that the way these rules get used as written is councils have had to either redefine the rule so that the 50% frontage is about 50% of the frontage width of all or part of the building, because what people do is they have a recessed part and a bit that's projecting forward, and then they argue that you only count the percentage from that particular bit of the facade that the garage door's in, not necessarily the whole one, or vice versa, and or limit it to the ground floor level. Because as written, 50% of the frontage, you could argue that's 50% of the whole surface area of a three-storey building, and a garage door is almost never going to be 50% of that. So my question is, what do you think the 50% is intended to mean? And then we can discuss whether or not the words will actually require that.
So it was intended to mean 50% of the frontage of the site, so the length of the site.
So the width of the site?
Yeah.
So it's a single dimension, it's not an area.
Not an area.
And what is the purpose of that?
About reducing the dominance of the garage in relation.
So if my building is 6 metres wide and my garage door is 6 metres wide, but my site is more than 12 metres wide, my garage can completely dominate the facade but not dominate the site. So we're talking about the site width or the building width within which the garage doors are.
Yeah, we're talking about the site width.
Okay.
But I take your point that perhaps in case the building is not maximised, the site, that perhaps the dominant garage would still exist.
Well, I don't know. It's your evidence here.
Yeah.
But we're talking about the frontage width in any event, whether it's a building or a site.
Yeah.
Okay. So perhaps you could just review those words in light of making sure there's no other creative interpretations of what 50% might mean. I'm mindful of a case in Long Bay in Auckland that nearly went to the Environment Court over what 50% meant, which I'm sure no one would want. 8.6.1.1, okay. So this is a non-notification rule. Residential units which comply with 8.4.1.1 8411, sorry. So if we then go to 8411, it's effectively four or more dwellings per site. So if I do three dwellings per site, I might get notified, but I do more intensive four or more, I don't. Because it's an 8410 has the permitted three unit up to three units. So why would there be a non-notification clause for the more intensive, more likely to have more adverse effects of concern to neighbours?
Because I didn't think that there was a need for a non-notification clause for the permitted activity. Am I confused?
Can I just clarify that what you're intending is that any residential development that requires consent to the obstructive discretionary activity would be non-notified?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, my question about 8410 is that, well, let's just think this through. You're assuming 8410 and 8411, in any event, one complies with every other relevant rule.
Yes, so if it needed a resource consent to breach the height, then that might be notified for
right.
The actual residential unit.
Okay, well, that was the heart of my question, was whether or not the way it was worded, the non-notification related to the activity, irrespective of any rule contraventions or not. So, for instance, I was thinking of 8410 in the context of I do three per site, but I'm not complying with the 250 site area rule, which is a different rule somewhere else, which isn't referred to.
Mm-hmm.
But you're comfortable then, in terms of the non-notification rule at 8.6, it's sufficiently clear that where it says anything that complies with 8411 actually means four or more dwellings that comply with every other relevant rule.
Yeah. Well, I'm not confident in that, but I'll have a look at
that. All right. So let's gain some confidence. Okay. Yeah, look, I think it's helpful. And the intention, therefore, is if I acquire 10 existing properties and did a 50 unit plan, all complying with the site areas and other rules of the plan,
mm-hmm.
that would be a non-notified proposal.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you. That was
good. Just, well, I was going to ask you a couple of small ones. There's one there about end of trip facilities, share cubicles and lockers. It's 8.2.4.3 and non-residential activities. I'm just wondering how well that fits in with this part of the plan overall. We're talking about medium density residential, and then we're talking about
That was intended to apply to the likes of commercial activities that may be acceptable in the zone or within the Wānaka Town Centre Transition Overlay area, and perhaps that policy could actually sit under the Wānaka Town Centre Transition Overlay objective in 8.2.10.
Or even 8.2.4.
Yeah.
Or 8.2.7, right. Which is the community activity switch.
Yeah, and then the same would probably go for the policy underneath that one, the 8.2.4.4, where I've added under that score non-residential activities as well.
Okay, so the first one, in regarding share the duty components and encourage one, once again, you get around to the issue of is it going to be built encouraged and how's it going to be encouraged? Just say, we'd like you to do that, but they say, no, that's it, I'll grant you, that's it.
if it's a commercial activity or a building within the one of the transitions overlay, which is the name of it, they need consent, so that's something that we can consider as part of that consent. And so perhaps it might be a small scale commercial activity that involves two people, where perhaps you wouldn't actually ask the end of trip facilities, but on a case by case basis you might.
Okay. I'm still not sure how that would work, but the other way is a bit of the training is done under the land project state highway 6 between Hitchin Road and Fury Drive. We're talking about,
we don't need to consider those.
Because the low impact stormwater network, that one there, I think they've already got the big pipes in, because a lot of wood comes off that hill.
That's been deferred.
Has it?
Oh, sorry, no. I can't say that. There's a question.
That's what I'm looking at.
I'll start asking you a more general question, which probably relates as much to the medium density residential as it does to the high density residential. And it came across, I had to go to Wellington recently, and one of the things I noticed in Wellington is they have a lot of apartments and a lot of high density or medium density development. I wonder if the council has actually taken the trouble to consider how some of these other localities have dealt with that situation through their rules and objectives and policies and achieved the level of density which I suspect is what the council wants to achieve here. Has that occurred? Do you know?
Not to my knowledge,
are you
about trying to promote density
through
apartments?
Well, even reading density, for instance, I noticed, having had a look at the local district plan, they don't require side or rear yards. And I'm not sure that the people of Wellington are a different breed from the New Zealanders who live in this district, but it seems to work. They also have the topography issues at Queenstown. And I just wonder if the council has taken trouble with it, how some of the other councils have dealt with these issues. But that's really what I was trying to get a handle on first.
Yeah, I'm not sure about... I know people that drafted the original chapter had similar experience in Australia, cities to I, where the medium and high density is something that's actively promoted over there. And so they may put that experience into in with them, but I'm not sure about New Zealand like that.
Okay. Just going to your section 32 report, section 42A. On page 30, talking about growing the capacity model, and in the little Y, you say that the total residential capacity under the ODP is between 17,000 and 18,000 dwellings. Do we have any indication of what it is under the proposed plan rules?
We don't have a dwelling capacity model yet for the proposed district plan. We're hoping to have that all set up and ready to go for the rezoning hearings. However, Mr. Pates, as part of his right of reply for strategic direction, put some numbers down as to how he got the extra 4,000 to 5,000 dwellings that he considers these zones and others are providing. But no, we haven't done the proper
So you're not able to help us as to what actual effect we could expect from the median density zone and its locations at this point?
No, not beyond what Mr. Pace has already provided.
And that's just broad numbers for the entire district?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, can I please just add something to that, if that's okay? Mr. Osborne did indicate in his evidence, I think, that he is doing some work on the capacity model, and that is to lead into the mapping hearings that is set down for next year, and will also have some link into the work to be studied as well. So that work is underway. At the moment, the evidence that we have is that was provided by Mr. Pates.
Questions that only need to be asked. Just on page 87, in paragraph 13.57, I just wondered whether there were you talking about the Arrowtown median density residential zone being located close to the Arrowtown centre, the Arrowtown town centre. The town centre really isn't the town centre for Arrowtown, is it? In other words, it's not a town centre that provides functions for the local population.
Look, on a day-to-day level, no, it doesn't provide the needs. But, you know, we're often in there in the weekends. It provides cafes, it provides the dairy, and a petrol station. So, it doesn't support the day-to-day needs of the community, but yes, it does serve eight function for the community.
Okay. I'll just note that across the page in section 14 again, the plot material storage, the same comments as we had the discussion yesterday apply. I've got some additional questions on your appendix 1. Because policy 8.2.2.7 am I reading it correctly that the intention is that if there are natural features such as vegetation, waterways, etc., that'll be remain part of the site, not be set aside as reserve or public space? Is that the intention of the policy?
Yes, that is the intention. It was about trying to incorporate features into sites, but then I guess if for example, I'm thinking about Bullet Creek and Wanaka, for example, you say you had a building beside that that wanted to have their outdoor seating area adjacent, yes, that would also, I think, be considered consistent with the policy because you're bringing that creek feature into the site. It's about not turning your back on it, but you know, having a building with its back against the river.
Just in 8.2.3.2, it says offsetting at the end of the policy, offsetting of habitable widows, which I suspect is a typo, screening or other means. Is it? Is what we're trying to say that the windows of habitable rooms get offset? Is that your intention?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, policy 8.2.4.4 and 1.3 talk about what's actually 4.3, talk about encouraging walking and cycling. And I was just wondering, in the light of those, whether, in fact, what the council is trying to say is that if there were more non-residential destinations closer or within the development, that would encourage walking instead or cycling. Is that one of the policy directions being sought in this study?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Given that, I guess, with the objective 8.2.1 about the being located close to town centres, it's
It just doesn't seem to, that doesn't come out though. Mm-hmm. And it might be also, because we have the subsequent ones on community activities and commercial activities that suggest that, but those don't get that across either. And I'm wondering whether there's some, if that was intended, whether that can be incorporated somewhere.
Yeah, it is intended.
Okay. Now, just on the objectives and policies for community activities. Objective and policies for community activities, that's 8.2.7 of the two policies that flow from.
Yes.
I'm having difficulty understanding that the policies are exactly the same as in the low density residential zone. Why are the rules that implement them different?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I can review those in the context of the two zones.
Yes, but it just seems to me that we have the same objectives and policies, then the implementation must be the same. Mm-hmm. in policy 8.2.8.3, you've rewritten it to mitigate commercial activities which generate adverse noise effects. What is it that you're intending to be mitigated?
The noise effects, not the commercial activity.
Now, in that same section, and policy 8.2.8.6 is relevant, the policies are quite clear that small commercial activities are to be provided for.
Mm-hmm.
But do these policies mean that shops, for example, in this zone have to have the same 4.5 metre setback or on the street frontage?
Yes, the intention is that they still have the same built form standards for residential, but they could have a commercial design.
Is that put in design to have a piece of wasted space in front of the commercial activity? I know that in the 70s, local shopping centres were designed with all these car parks out front, but I thought we got past that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm thinking, you know, the successful examples of small scale commercial activities and our existing low density zone are mainly located on corners or on beside parks or something. So that, yeah, what I was anticipating is, you know, a one long street and you've got a commercial activity smack bang along the middle, and it would stick out a lot in urban design terms if it was, you know, something built up to the street or within. So that's why it's going along the lines of that being consistent with that. On some sites, you know, for example, a corner site where, you know, you had your traditional corner dairy type building, that might be suitable to bridge that.
Are you familiar with Dunedin?
Very.
North Dunedin?
Yes.
There are a number of corner shops along, for example, Castle Street, Cumberland Street, where they're right on the street frontage, which from an urban design point of view seems to work reasonably well. And I have to admit, initially I was thinking of ones in Auckland that are near the register, but the Dunedin one is easier to relate to. Is that the sort of thing that you think would be appropriate in the scene?
Yeah, so I wonder if those ones in Dunedin work because of the age of them.
Well, that's because in the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, they didn't have study town planners and they couldn't build up to the street frontage.
Yeah, true.
And we're trying to move on. Isn't that what modern urban design is trying to capture some of those beneficial advantages that were achieved in the early 20th century development and ameliorate the adverse aspects?
So I guess what you're saying is perhaps look at allowing some flexibility in the design where it's not.
Yes, well, I'm just worried that residential. I know that in some suburban centres in other parts of the country where they've had setbacks in shops and they haven't been used for parking, they tend to just be rubbish dumps, quite frankly. The poorly landscape, rubbish in them, and that just reduces the neighbourhood amenity, which is contrary to what the council is trying to achieve. So. did have a question about 8.3.2.4, which is in that clarification section, and I'm hoping that you will be able to reconsider that whole section so it may disappear. With rule 8.4.6, I was just wondering why activities move around the narrative. Given the existing supermarket in the residential area seems to operate very well.
I honestly don't know why
Arrowtown
was excluded.
Mm. There's probably no one seeking it, right? With the Arrowtown Historic Management Transition Overlay area, we haven't been given any indication where that might apply in the maps.
The map should have been in the appendix.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, appendix 9 to the section 42 A report.
I take it in terms of the height limit, the 7 metres in Waikato is for the same reason as the lady is here in the just in response to me. Now, with this square heights and the issue of the crack, have you walked along that crack?
Okay.
Yes. In terms of the topography, is it really necessary to be 6 metres away from the Zoundary to avoid impacting on the views?
Not necessarily. The standard sort of input in the chapter for those recommended to me by Mr. Falconer. I have seen the evidence of, I think it's Mr. Williams or Mr. Greaves, about width and the height of the pathway in relation to that land, and when I walked it, I would obviously not know where the boundary is in relation to the trail. And so I think that
fence is the boundary.
Sorry?
The fence.
Yeah, but I don't know whether that is an implication of the actual of the actual boundary. But you know, sometimes they're in the wrong location.
The other question I have is, if there's an additional setback on there, I think it's 6 metres you're proposing in 9 metres, 6 metres, that must inherently be on the south side of those properties.
Sorry,
Thank you.
east side.
No, so that's not such a problem. When you walked along the trail, did you walk all the way along to where the new buildings had just been built off by Bay Place?
Yeah, so I walked down from the top.
Yes.
I did.
Amongst the pine trees?
Yeah.
Yes. Were you able to see across the those buildings?
No.
So you're back to the tall.
Yeah.
My wife could see some of the way across. I discussed with Mr. Faulkner yesterday whether a rule similar to applying on the Frankton Road may be a more practical way of dealing with the matter there, which was a height based in relation to the level of track. I understood from his response his only concern was that that could be higher than ground level of the track, because the Frankton one was done from sitting in a car, whereas you'd be walking or cycling on that track.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any views on whether that would be a means of dealing with the issue without having a standardised limitation?
Yeah, I think that's an entirely reasonable suggestion. I think what the standards that we've notified perhaps will allow more height than that in Frankton.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, well, that would definitely solve it.
Well, it still has to be focused on height anyway.
Yes, that's yes. Right. I'm not sure that the landowners of that land will like that, but given that that's where the majority of the views are going to come from for that development, and that's obviously where they're coming from.
Well, we certainly ask the same questions as Mr. Williams in the week after next. Now, with rule 8.5.8, I may have misunderstood the rule, but how can you have terrace housing when that rule seems to require 3 metres between each house, each building?
Yes, that's something I just picked up last night when I was rereading this, that there's no exception for terrace housing.
But there isn't the road density.
Yes, but there isn't the road density. But yeah, that's something that's been missing.
I only have one more question, so I'll ask that before we have lunch. No, two more questions, actually. Rule 8.5.13, just to do with the National Grid Central Activities, is it necessary for that rule to be there if it's also in Chapter 36? I know that Transpower wants it to be in every chapter possible, but I'd really like your opinion as to whether we need to repeat it or not.
No, I don't think it needs to be replicated. And yeah, same as same submission. And I understand that the way that the plan's being drafted is that all the district-wide rules have gone into district-wide chapters, and they weren't supposed to be replicated in the rules, in the chapters for the zones such as this.
Okay. Yeah. The other question I have is a more general one, and it's to do with the approach overall. And I don't mind if, after I've asked the question, you think about it over lunch time in the Ply House for lunch rather than a couple of minutes later. in the same, and it probably applies in ideas from the nature of seven as well, is density important, or is it the scale and location of the built form that's important? In other words, should the district plan be identifying appropriate built form levels, and whether there are six household units living within the building or one, for to be concerned? And I raise this knowing that in Europe, quite often it is the built form that's controlled rather than the number of houses or dwellings within. I'm happy if you take the lunch time to think about that.
I was going to ask if I could ask almost the exact same question. So,
yes.
Can I clip something onto the end of that?
Sure.
That's what you ought to think about. In terms of your answer, if you could also confirm what objective or policies, if any, you think the current site and density rules may be being derived from.
Okay, well, in that case, I'll do PPM.